Major Lease, Reel 6. You were describing the task system. You mentioned number one, was the vehicle clean?
Oh, yes, but I did have some books I kept. We had to listen to the tasks. Every day a task on a vehicle had to be carried out. The tires, what was the pressure of the tires? The driver had to make it out. And it just lasted for 28 or 30 days. And from time to time, the platoon commander would check it. And then it used to be sent then to the company commander, who used to also check it. And we had to sign it and make signal marks in the book. This was the way the army operated its transport in those days. During that period, the workshop in the RASC companies was also inspected. So it was a book set out on those lines.
You said that sometimes they broke down. Was there a particularly prevalent cause of breakdown?
Yes, well, I will recall, soon as it may be, they would suddenly say, well, the cylinder head nuts are tight. Of course, some ham-fisted driver, who knew nothing very much about transport, would get a spanner and see if the nuts were tight and tighten them up so tight that the nuts would over-tighten and blow themselves off. That frequently used to happen. These RASC companies, they could not begin to change their engines. New engines would be put in. So it was just general maintenance, I suppose, of engine trouble, which any vehicle would, in those days, would have to. So it was a private car.
Did you have a turnover of drivers coming in and out of the company at that time?
We tried to keep the same drivers. Of course, people went sick, and new people had to come in from the ranks and from City Street into the army, out of the army, and trained as drivers. Then they'd be sent to the RASC companies as trained drivers.
But were you being affected by demobilisation at this stage, with long-serving soldiers going back?
No, that of course, when all the trouble started, because the new drivers came in and the old people were going out.
So the older people were better, they were more experienced?
They were very, very experienced. Then in later years, I don't know if you want me to continue, in later years, when I'd come home with things in the UK, went back to Germany again, I was commanding a German transport company. That was in some years. Now, German transport companies were German soldiers who, after the war, were taken over by the British and made into attached German transport companies. They were semi-soldiers, really. And these companies were organized on the same lines as a German transport, an English transport company with their German officers and a German major, and also a British major who was the commander, and a staff sergeant who was in charge of stores, and a remis, so that was a sort of staff. So, now immediately after all, my officer, I forget his name, it's not on the tip of my tongue, but I knew him well. when the British arrived, he was hiding up in a wood somewhere. It was a complete transport company. And the British officers arrived and said, all officers, all German officers report to the camp down the road as prisoners. All the men stopped there. And this man was pretty astute. He saluted and said, yeah, well, I'll see to that. My officer will do as they were told. He stopped there in his woods and then reported to the military government. He said, there's a transport company at your disposal, sir. They said, fine. So the whole company, vehicles, the whole lot, was property used by the British forces. These transport companies went on in existence until many recent years.
How did you get on with them?
They were absolutely magnificent. They were old soldiers, very smart, and did everything we wanted them to do. And of course we had we would come and inspect them, and there was several of them were about around the countryside, and there was a sort of competition. And my people were so good, I remember they came number top for transport companies in Germany. They also had their own workshops. Vehicles would be turned out, old vehicles would come out for inspection if they were almost making new. Because these people were so, so good.
What sort of
they used to send up young subalterns from where it was, railway station, near Bielefeld. They used to come up for lessons from the German soldiers on how to look after transport.
Did they have the same vehicles as you had? Or
well, yes, because they were just issued as new vehicles. Army vehicles. And we had Volkswagens, I remember. It'd be a hell of a fellow, because I had my own Volkswagen. My own driver. And I was living in Bielefeld. And I went up the road some miles with my German driver. I could drive over the whole of Germany if everyone wanted to, when I was always on duty. And as I was some of these colonels and God knows what, with loud phones, me being a simple major, we also allowed the phone because I was a unit commander. I was at the station, living actually in Bielefeld, in the next to the barracks there, in our army quarters.
These German quarters?
Yes, well, in those days, when I first went there, we took over our German quarters, and they built British quarters.
What were the German quarters like? How did they compare to British?
Well, before going back to I was doing, just before I was talking about the German transport companies, I was doing on the corps headquarters doing in charge of barracks, which we at the whole of Germany, the whole of the north of Germany, we were responsible for supplying everything in that area to the barrack furniture, etc. And we had huge depots, and we used to supply the coal for all the forces all around the country, that part of Germany. I think we called ourselves a barrack officer or something.
How did their accommodation compare to ours, their barrack accommodation, their quarters?
They had German quarters.
Mm.
And I was given a quarter of a place called Bielefeld, called Rundstrasse. It was a magnificent place. Mm. A big old country, big house on a lovely street. And we had everything there. And I can recall down as you went into these German quarters, just where you could drive into the garage. So one drove into the garage and where one car was kept. Then one went up steps past the boiler house into one's house. And it was all said in those days where people used to say, this place is haunted. Because all of a sudden you'd hear the doors creak downstairs as if somebody was coming in. Some people were staying there, or maids or something, or kept it. And the people coming in with the yacht are quite frightened in the office.
Did you have any contact with the local civilian population?
Yes, we did. We had a lot of, we used to employ German staff. All the barrack officers which came under the district barrack officer. Every garrison town had its own barrack services. Mm. So everything was supplied from coal, furniture, everything else. That was known as the barrack office.
Of local purchase.
They used to local purchase.
Mm.
And one occasion, in one of the big towns around Germany, we had these terrific coal yards, all about half a mile long or a quarter of a mile long, and in the middle, stacks and stacks of coal. And we had to the officers in charge and the district barrack officer used to have to go and calculate how much coal there was there. There was a formula whereby when measures height and the width and God knows what multiplied by something other, and that was the amount of tons of coal in that stack. So everybody thought that was grand. And so the returns used to go in. And on one occasion, the district barrack officer, somebody else, luckily before I got there, decided to investigate this coal, this particular stack of coal. And inside they found it had all been stuffed up, and there wasn't hardly any coal at all.
Well, it's hollowed out.
It had been hollowed out.
Mm-hmm.
The smart Germans and probably the leaders of some sergeant or other have been following the curls of people outside, taking absolute mint.
Did you come across other instances of that sort of illegal trading?
There was always a fiddle in these bad stores going on somewhere.
Mm.
One had to go in and do spot checks.
In this case, did they find out who'd been doing it?
I think they probably might have done, because the military police had to come in and reports flew everywhere.
In the early days in Germany, did you see anything of the other Allied forces, the Russians or the French or the Americans?
We had no dealings with them at all.
Really.
Mm. So I can tell you another interesting one. It escaped my mind when we were going to be the Monazee when I was there. The war had just finished, and who should arrive there but the big car manufacturer, Volkswagen car. I can't just recall his name, arrived in a car with a chauffeur, goodness knows what. And he said, came up to me and up on the just behind in the woods, I have a source. I said, oh yes, well, I want permission to go up and take some things from my source, because this source had been requisitioned by the army before we got there. I put an engineer unit, and I said, yes, we'll come back. But in due course, he came back, and serving with me as one of my captains was the ex-police officer. He was a nice chap. He was a superintendent or something. And his name was Ted Crabb. And I said to Ted, now, you take this man up. Herr von Opel, his name was Herr von Opel. Everyone named Tom von Opel. And they got into their car, his big car together, and they drove up some miles to the Schloss. And on the way up, he said, well, when I get there, I will be able to give your wife a nice present, probably a nice fur coat, because we've got all the things locked up in the great safes up there. And they said, how nice. Have a nice fur coat. And then they drove up. They said, where are the keys? Well, I didn't have the keys. Nobody else had the keys. Well, it was too bad. Couldn't get in. So back he went. And a few days later on, he came up with a safe breaker. Tim Pell up, went up with him again. And the safe breaker started from this huge safe, which was big as all. And it took him about half an hour to cut a hole in the safe. Hmm. The safe was opened, and inside I found one coat hanger.
That was all?
That was all. All this wonderful thing. After that, of course, all hell was let loose. Because I had to then very hastily send a reporter. No army headquarters or something about this horror. All the military police arrived to check it all over. But what had happened apparently, this place, when the war just ended, was being occupied by a military unit. I think they were sappers or engineers, this lovely source, you see. And that was. So then the police town were informed, and they wanted to find out where this major lived, where the commander lived, and they found that one out in his records, and the police raided his house. They found all kinds of things in the house, probably there, von Opel. After that, he was recalled to the colors in a big way, and he was court-martialed. And he was charged with doing all these horrors. And you know what happened to him? He was severely reprimanded. He went promptly and sent home. Some of the generals and people and those at home were very cross about this. That is a history of Herr von Opel. Herr von Opel is the death afterwards. He was very cunning altogether. But that whole the war, to be on the right side, he had sent his son and some of his family before the war started off to America, where he got tied up with Americans, and he was running a nice Opel factory out there.
So he had a foot in each camp?
No one but in the camp. He'd all made himself American. Mm.
But he got a foot in each camp, hadn't he? The family were in.
Herr von Opel, they were a bit nice of his father. I don't know if they'd arrested him. They may have arrested him for war crimes, and he was let free. He hadn't done anything very much.
Did he get his property back?
I never knew anything about his property. I doubt it, because all the troops, a nice largest unit, 20 or 30 men, they'd all had a bit of it, so it was scattered over the countryside. That was the funny thing, that Herr von Opel.
think your next move after Germany was to Malaya. How did that happen?
Okay. Now, I think you wanted to know as regards my posting to Malaya from this country. I won't give you dates at the moment, but perhaps later on. Anyhow, well, I was posted to Malaya, leaving my family behind here, who would join us later on. Well, we were put on a troop ship, and we were sent out to Malaya. I think the journey to Malaya was approximately 28 days. Calling at various ports of the way. Nice journey. And on arriving there, I was the major and was put in charge of a Malay transport company. We had a large number of vehicles, the usual number, of course, not so many, workshops, etc., etc. And we ran the transport all around Singapore. Now, we had two or three, myself as a major, a transport officer who's in charge of the transport from the workshop side. About three or four other platoon commanders who had to command the platoons. And of course, then the drivers came under them, with a number of NCOs, British NCOs. Of course, none of us could speak Malay, very few of us could speak Malay. And so it was very difficult controlling these people. Well, the drill was that they had to train these Malays, and they literally collected them out of the jungles of Malaya after the war. They probably never lived in a mud hut somewhere and never knew anything about transport. So they got them to the British services as soldiers, and they were brought in and trained as drivers. And they were trained up, outside Singapore at a driving training centre, which was at Misu. There was a big camp up there. The drivers were trained, and then they were sent off as drivers here and there and everywhere. And they had, of course, better people, Chinese drivers as well. So that was the makeup of the company.
Do you know roughly what the proportions were of Malays and Chinese in the company?
Very difficult to tell. The Chinese were pretty clued up, and of course they were more highly educated, so there were about 10 or 15% Chinese, the rest were Malays. And the transport was, they were very old vehicles, and we were in this central Malaya, they were in the big park. And all the tools were supposed to be with the vehicles. As you know, on a vehicle they had a tool kit, because most of the tools were missing. And they were supposed to hand over from one driver to another. And of course, there was a lot of fiddling going on with tools. On one occasion, these drivers used to remove their petrol caps off their petrol, the caps off their vehicles. And then they lost the petrol caps, and that was that. And they had to hide their tools and take them into the barrack rooms and put them all, because they couldn't lock them up. There was a general shortage. And I remember there was one horror. and some driver who shouldn't have been driving, or wasn't a fully trained driver, took a vehicle out to meet some of the people coming from the docks. And the silly clown upset the vehicle, turned it over, so he couldn't really drive it. And a British soldier was killed as a result. So this made things very difficult indeed.
Could you do things to improve matters? What could you do to...
Well, we did our best, and it was the ordnance, so we wouldn't supply them bits and pieces. But we slowly got it right. And that was it. After that,
What did you do for Air Dispatch? What was your role there?
I was OC Company at Air Dispatch, and the Air Dispatch Company was at the place I called it, Nisu. That was the Air Dispatch Company headquarters. Now, there, we had entirely British troops, a full company of British troops, very top quality people really. And the setup was, we had our company headquarters in Nisu, and up at Kuala Lumpur in the middle of Malaya, on one of the aerodromes, we had all the Dakotas. And with another platoon there who used to supply the crews for air dispatching. So supplies of parachutes were sent up, they came in, I suppose from the UK or anything like that. We used to collect them. And then these parachutes used to be sent up to Malaya, to Kuala Lumpur on the RAF field there. And also with everything other suppliers, baskets, hampers, etc., for dropping suppliers. Now, the drill was that the troops then were operating in the jungle and Malaya all around the place. And they had to be supplied by air and airdrops. And so we were notified by the military authorities where, by radio, where that particular platoon or section was operating. And then they needed supplies, everything, think of ammunition, I couldn't dispose of, what is required. The notification was given that a platoon was in the jungle at a given area, and the planes were loaded, these Dakota planes, one of which I think is still here, in old software, you can see it, there was a Dakota, they had loaded the stores for supplying the troops in the air. Now, in those days, the Dakotas had side doors, so everything had to be pushed out from the side on parachutes. Well, they used to have, I suppose, one or two RAF types there, and four or five handlers from RASC in the main part of the aerodrome. And as you flew across, coming into the area, the troops would know about what time it was coming, and you would see a smoke signal going up in the distance. And that was an indication that there was a platoon there wanting supplies. And so the RAF would come in and circle around fairly close to the ground having a check-up. Now, where the troops were, they generally used to have to clear an area of jungle, because the jungle was very thick, and this was known as a dropping zone. Mm. So when you had located them,